Today's program has been brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. For more information, visit TechServe.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
I'm your host, Helen Holliman, and I am back for another week of radio at Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And today, we are discussing death row inmates' last meals. I'm joined by a fellow who knows many, many things about this topic, Zach Shemtob. He's received a PhD at John Jay for criminal justice, studying the death penalty. He's taught as a professor of penology, more specifically, the topic of death row. Zach, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Glad to be here.
Did I get all of that correct?
Absolutely. pretty much in broad brush strokes. I also am semi-familiar with radio from hosting a podcast on punishment. So I'm very excited to be here because I'm usually the one asking the questions as opposed to the one answering them.
My, how the tables have turned.
You got
it. Well, let's start in the very beginning, and let's discuss the history of how did, you know, the concept of offering a last meal begin?
Well, it's pretty controversial, like anything else with the death penalty, but the best research is that it began back in the day. You trace it to Greece, to China, but in terms of European style, it was to give people meals so the person, after they died, would not haunt the executioner as a revenant or a ghost, so it wouldn't haunt the executioner, the people who watched it, anyone involved with the process, kind of like a peace offering that they wouldn't take their revenge.
So, in America, I'm going to read off some numbers to get us in the mentality here. By region, the South is leading in executions. Since 1976, there's been a total of 1,328 executions. In the South, there were 1,086 of those. In the Midwest, 156. In the West, 82. And in the Northeast, 4. So the leading state of executions to date is my home state, Texas, at 495. Virginia comes in at second with 110. Then there's Oklahoma, and so on and so on.
Yeah, Texas gets a lot of the blame, and they deserve much of the blame. That being said, if you actually look at the per capita numbers of which state executes the most people percentage-wise, the big winner is Oklahoma. So while everyone looks at Texas and California, which has a moratorium, but it has the most people on death row, in terms of actual executions for their population, the most vicious state is Oklahoma rather than Texas or Virginia or Florida, who are the usual suspects.
Twofold question. Describe what happens physically when you receive lethal injection. And also, why do some states still have the electric chair?
It's a complicated answer. There are two drugs that are generally used, two types of lethal injection procedures. One is a single drug. The other one is a three-drug cocktail. The three-drug cocktail works in a way where the first drug paralyzes you, the second drug numbs you, and the third drug then stops your heart. It turns out that what may be happening is the first drug may be paralyzing you, the second drug not working, and the third stopping your heart, meaning you're in incredible pain and you can't do anything to cry out because you're paralyzed. Because of this, it may be unconstitutional to have the three-drug cocktail, and they've changed it to a one-drug cocktail. Now, this is still very controversial. It was decided in a case called Bayes versus Rees in the Supreme Court. But regardless of the constitutionality issues, which are why we have a moratorium in California, there's also the issue that we're running out of this drug. And it's produced in Denmark and was in England. And now that Denmark is no longer giving it to us because it was an epilepsy drug that they think is abominable that we use for executions, we're having a lot of trouble actually getting this drug. And therefore, some states have moved back to the electric chair. But there's some crazy stories about wardens telling people to sneak into Denmark or other countries in order to illicitly get this drug and then sneak it back to the United States and use it. So we're actually committing internationally illegal acts in order to kill people in the United States. And it's led to this big mess of drug supplies. And so some are just saying, okay, well, lethal injection may be more humane, and or it may not be if the drugs aren't working. But since we don't have enough of it and we can't get enough of it, let's just go back to the old ways, the electric chair. They're not going to bring back hanging, I'd imagine, or the firing squad, but the electric chair after lethal injection has long been number two. So we may see more of that, even though executions overall have been decreasing from a high in 1999.
The only other country in the world that executes people is Japan, right?
Well, not the only other country in the world. The only other so-called industrialized nation. Plenty of other countries execute people. For instance, Iran crucifies people, which is kind of a terrifying thing, as well as occasionally in the villages takes adulterers, buries them underground with only their head sticking out, and then stones them to death. China has execution vans, which are literally a van will pull into a village, sometimes of political dissidents. They will grab people in the village, throw them in the van, lethally inject them, and then throw them outside the van. So, yes, the other number two, which practices by hanging, is Japan in terms of, again, so-called industrialized nations, but it's practiced throughout much of the world.
Do they offer last meals in Japan?
That I do not know, because generally with Japan, they don't tell you when you are going to die. They just bring you out in the morning to be hanged. So it seems unlikely given the death day is not set as it is in the United States.
I'd love to talk about quote-unquote budgets for last meals and sort of the logisticals of, you know, I've heard that in some states, like, family members can bring in a cooked meal. Other states, you know, you order Domino's. You know, how does it work?
Yeah, it's very different than people like to conceptualize. So a lot of people think, oh, for my last meal, I would have, especially those more bourgeois of us, would say, I want, you know, truffles or, you know, uni or something like that, which I probably would get. But no, that's not going to happen. How it actually works is states have budgets. Some do not. California does not. But those that do have a very tight budget. The federal government, which executes people, has a $20 budget. Some states have a $15 budget. And other states have a $40 budget. And what ends up happening is most people just order food within the prison itself. So the prison chef cooks their favorite meal, whatever that is. Occasionally, but it's a small percentage of people will order a meal from the outside of the prison, but it can't be too outside the prison. They're not going to go to, you know, another county even or another state to pick up your favorite meal. It's something, you know, that makes sense. Like, again, Domino's or Kentucky Fried Chicken, which is one of the most common, or another really common one is McDonald's, Burger King. All of those are very common, and they will ask for that, and that will often be granted, though not in all states. In all states, some states, as well, I think we'll discuss, don't even have last meals anymore. But it's not that you can order anything. It's that you can order something that can be cooked on site or can be grabbed from very close to the prison.
How many inmates would you say actually request last meals?
About 50%. 50% are too nervous or just not interested in eating. Maybe they're not food people. And the other 50% will request a specific last meal.
Who is cooking the food?
It varies state by state, but often it is one of the prisoners who has been commissioned to work in the kitchen. So it's not necessarily a professional, chef in the kitchen, but someone like another prisoner who works there and knows what people want.
So if they're designated to be in the kitchen, they have to cook, right?
I mean, well, it's a good job. I mean, actually, I shouldn't say that because I've spoken to some prisoners who absolutely hate kitchen work and then they try to get into the library, which is more common. But it's one of those jobs that prisoners go for because they're allocated among the people in the prison. If you want to read more specifically about this, there's actually a former prison chef who was an inmate himself who wrote a book called Meals to Die For. His name is Brian Price, and he talks about his recipes, his favorite recipes for last meals.
Favorite recipes meaning he loves to cook them? Or
meaning what people wanted, the meals he liked to cook, you know, the best meals to die for. It's disturbing stuff.
Wow. So I would love to talk about a specific last meal. There were two very, publicized death row cases in 2011, Troy Davis.
Yes.
We all probably watched that highly televised situation. And then directly after that, there was a fellow in Texas, Mr. Lawrence Brewer.
Yes, the James Byrd case.
Talk a little bit about the case, and then I will tell you guys what he ate, or sorry, what he requested.
It's quite something. The Brewer case is a horrific case. I don't know if the listeners will remember, but James Byrd was an African-American who was tied behind a truck and then dragged to his death. It was one of the worst racially motivated crimes of recent times. Certainly nothing compared to the horrors inflicted on blacks in this country in the past, but a terrible crime. And Brewer and his accomplices were put in prison. I believe it was three men. And Brewer had a very interesting last meal request, which caused so much trouble that they actually banned last meals in Texas.
So he ended up ordering two fried chicken steaks with gravy and sliced onions, a triple patty bacon cheeseburger, a cheese omelet with ground beef, tomatoes, onions, bell peppers, and jalapenos, a bowl of fried okra with ketchup, 1 pound of barbecued meat with half a loaf of white bread, three fajitas, a meat lover's pizza, 1 pint of Bluebell ice cream, a slab of peanut butter fudge with crushed peanuts, and three root beers.
And did not eat any of it. It was a final screw you to the system.
And interestingly enough, I knew that Troy Davis bowed out of eating. And what I didn't know was what the prison actually offered him, which was a tray of grilled cheeseburgers, oven-browned potatoes, baked beans, coleslaw, cookies, and grape beverage.
And all things considered, these are relatively normal last meals. Maybe not in the size of them, but another one that was ordered I read about was a fellow who wanted a black olive with a pit, because he hoped an olive tree would grow inside him and it would spread peace after he died. Another fellow wanted a bag of Jolly Ranchers. He really liked Jolly Ranchers. I actually cannot stand Jolly Ranchers, so I don't get that one. But perhaps the most disturbing one was a fellow who demanded dirt from his grave. He said, "I want you to go to my planned grave, get a bucket of dirt, and I will consume that as my last meal." They did not give it to him.
We are going to take a very quick break, but when we get back, lots more from Zach Shemtob. You're listening to You Look Hungry. Stay tuned.
This special program was brought to you by TechServe, New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and service provider, serving creative professionals at all levels, from individual customers to Fortune 100 companies. TechServe has built a solid reputation in their expertise in technology, sales, and service. Visit them on the web at techserve.com or in New York City at 119 West 23rd Street. Learn more about their in-store classes and incredible insider program. Make stuff happen. TechServe. You're listening to Shapeshifter by Knife Show on heritageradionetwork.org.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm still your host, Helen Holliman, and today we're talking about death row inmates' last meals. I'm joined by Zach Shemtob, fellow who is quite the man to talk about this stuff with.
Sadly enough.
And before the break, we were discussing, you know, what people have been eating and some of the legal stuff that's involved. And I distinctively, last year, interviewed a chef and artist named Julia Ziegler-Haynes, who came on the show. She wrote a book, created a book called Today's Special, and it was about recreating the last meals of death row inmates, photograph them. We were talking about this one person in particular who, when he ate his last meal, said, "I will save the rest for later."
Yeah, that wasn't a joke, is the sad thing. The Supreme Court has found that you cannot execute people who are not below a certain IQ level, but who are considered mentally handicapped. The thing is, that's set by each state. So some states have set the bar to be mentally handicapped really, really high, or should I say low. And as a result of that, are still executing people who are, I would think, without a doubt, fit the description of what we would consider to be mentally handicapped, and even what the court would consider to be mentally handicapped. But this is an issue that the Supremes don't like to get too involved with.
Prisoners are not allowed to smoke or to drink alcohol before their last meal.
No, not in the United States. The only case of alcohol consumption I read about was not in the United States. It was actually the execution of Adolf Eichmann, the Nazi war criminal who was executed after the Nuremberg trials in Israel. The last thing he had was, ironically enough, Israeli wine, about half a bottle of it.
Who is the executioner?
The executioner is generally a prison employee who didn't come in to be an executioner. This might vary on occasion, but roughly speaking, it's an employee who's paid a little extra on the side to conduct executions. And there are some videos of people who are former executioners speaking, who talk about how being an executioner brought them against the death penalty. One actually talked about how it was actually looking at the last meals of some of those who were executed. I think he described looking at beans or something that someone had requested, since that's what his mother used to cook, and at that moment slowly turning against the death penalty. Now, whatever one's stance on the death penalty is, of course, it's still a very fascinating, powerful thing.
Do executioners receive any kind of support from the state in terms of, like, therapy or dealing with act of what they're doing?
They'd have the same therapy allocated to anyone else at the prison. Maybe they might need more therapy sessions. But, I mean, this is a difficult topic in terms of their identities are really kept confidential. At one point, years ago, for my dissertation, I wanted to write on executioners and interview them, asking them if conducting executions turned them against the death penalty, or they were indifferent, or even made them more for the death penalty. But you can't get the information because it's confidential, which shows that even when it comes to that, we're ashamed about our death penalty, because people have argued, they're not going to be safe if their identities are revealed, but safe from, they're going to be in danger from who? So it's really, to me, it's more of a shame thing that these people are being tasked to do this than anything else.
I mean, financially speaking, I'm guessing they're probably not making that much.
No, no, they're state employees in an area, a sector where you're not paid very much at all.
Let's talk about last words.
Absolutely. Accompanying last meals, which come 1 to 2 days before, people are very fascinated. How I became fascinated by last meals was through last words. So the final thing that someone will say. There was one, as the story goes, one guy, they asked, "What are your last words before you're executed?" And he looked at them and he said, "Such is life." And that was it. There was one of the interesting ones is in 76, which is when the modern death penalty regime began after the Supreme Court case, Gregg versus Georgia. The first execution was Gary Gilmore. Now, Gary Gilmore was also written about in the book Executioner's Song by Norman Mailer, which is an excellent book. And Gary Gilmore's last words were, let's do it, something to that effect. And there was actually a witness who heard let's do it and heard it wrongly as just do it. And as the story goes, actually became the fellow who wrote the Nike slogan.
No. And
that's supposedly where the Nike slogan comes from, the last words of Gary Gilmore.
I don't know if I can wear Nike anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, I've looked into the story, and I found some decently credible sources. So it's hard to believe, but it seems to have been the case.
So let's talk about, you know, what happens in the room in terms of, you know, are family members of the victims allowed in, or how does that work?
Yeah, you generally have a screen. The person's in a room, and on the other side are family members of the murdered, family members of the person being put to death, and then the media. And the media then, I think you have like 3 tickets for media people who usually cover this. And then they're the ones who go on and write about it. I find that whole thing problematic. I personally think that if we're going to have executions, they should be public. This was my initial research and what I've written on. But for the time being, and I don't think it's going to change, is you have just a select group of people who are able to do it. And for everyone else, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind, unless it's a highly publicized execution like Timothy McVeigh.
Do you feel like we're executing the same amount of people? Or
we're executing less.
Less. Okay.
Yeah. I think last year was 42. And the peak was in 99, which was in the 90s. The peak, I mean, of since 1976. So the number has been steadily decreasing. It usually goes in accordance with the crime rate and heinous events. So when you have a low crime rate, as we do now, although it's been perhaps picking up a little, and you don't have terrible events, although this has obviously changed in the last few days, you generally see a lower execution rate. When the crime rate spikes up, more people are for it. They demand it from the politicos, so more people are executed. It's not a perfect correlation. For instance, in the 90s, you had low crime but high executions, but usually you see it in that direction.
What's a state that in the U.S. people might be surprised at the amount of people that they execute?
Oh, I still think it has to be Oklahoma. I mean, you know, there were a bunch of northeastern states that were still executing, but that's been mostly cut off. I know New Hampshire still does, but it's very few. Mostly the states are, though, the usual suspects, as I'll call them, and then Midwestern states, which do surprise people in how active death row is there.
Have you ever interviewed a death row inmate?
No, I've interviewed people who have, you know, been in prison for life and people who have come out of prison for different crimes, but death row inmates are hard to get to.
What do you think is in our future for the justice system in terms of death row?
The death penalty is not going away anytime soon, I would predict. However, I think states are gradually going to abolish it, and the more states that abolish it, the more likely the court will at some point take it up and then just get rid of it altogether, because they'll say evolving standards of decency, which is the test. They'll say at this point the country doesn't really want it anymore. There's a few outliers, but it's no longer the civilized or constitutional thing to do. And then I think so you'll see eventually, maybe, you know, now there are 33 states who execute people, which is still quite a bit. Maybe when it's in the 20s, then the Supreme Court will step in. I think that's what Justice Kennedy, who's the swing vote on these issues, is waiting for. Conceivably, if you got a court more to the left, then they might take up the case sooner. But as far as the death penalty coming to an end anytime soon, I find it unlikely. Wow. Someone's angry.
Someone's real mad, yeah. Upstairs. Women on death row.
Rare. There are some, I think maybe 2 in the last year or something. That number could be off. But generally, heinous crimes are men's game at this point. As for whether juries are more likely to sentence women to death, the data is mixed. It doesn't have the same correlation as African Americans and specifically victims. So generally you'll find with the death penalty, likelihood of being executed is not based on the defendant or the alleged murderer's skin color, it's the victim's skin color. So you're really screwed if you're black and you've killed a white person. You're less screwed if you're white and you've killed a black person.
I've asked this before. Well, I didn't ask it before. I know you mentioned it slightly, but if you had to have a last meal, what would it be?
I thought you were going to ask that question. So let me. I actually wrote down on a piece of paper so I would remember. This is theoretically not what I could get. This is what, in a perfect world, what I would be able to get. All right, this is we're talking about bourgeois last meals. This is one that would never be ordered, but by anyone but me. But I would want popovers, French onion soup. I would want some sort of salad with Stilton cheese, uni risotto with black truffles, a duck breast, pork chop, barbecue pork ribs, double stuffed baked potato, and Brussels sprouts. And I would like bread pudding to top it all off.
Hot damn. That is a meal.
In truth, I'm sure I would be way too nervous to ever order that, never mind consume it. And I would probably end up getting, like, you know, tacos from Taco Bell or something. But yes, off the top of my head, if you were to say you're going to die tomorrow, you can have any meal in the world, that would be it.
I think I would want just a really large glass of delicious bourbon with a big ice cube.
Yeah, I would have scotch as well on the side, but I can't go out without having, you know, at least a pork chop and double stuffed baked potato and bread pudding.
Well, Zach, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
And uncovering this intense topic. And for more information about Zach, you can check out his amazing podcasts, All About Punishment, on your website.
It's Cruel and Unusual, a podcast on punishment.
Check it out. And as always, thanks so much to Jack Inslee, Joe Galarraga, and the rest of the crew at Heritage Radio and Roberta's. See y'all next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Changes my mood, eating those yummy old fries. One time.